Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley. On my right is Judge Greenberg. On my left is Judge Toth. We're here today for the matter of Batcher v. Wilkie, docket number 16-638. The issue before the court is whether and to what extent the terms of a separation agreement affect a spouse's entitlement to a, quote, special apportionment, unquote, under VA Regulation 3.451, and whether the board properly explained its decision. Would counsel for the parties please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel?
John Camerotis, Your Honor, for the appellant.
Thank you. And the secretary?
Brian Thompson, on behalf of the secretary, Your Honor. I'm joined by Chris Attaway, counsel.
Very good. Thank you. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes? Yes? Okay, great. And Mr. Camerotis, did you wish to reserve any portion of your time?
7 minutes, Your Honor.
Dawn, 7 minutes. Okay, good. Thank you. Mr. Camerotis, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. At issue in this matter is whether a state court settlement agreement can result in a waiver of apportionment benefits. Simply put, in this matter, the appellant's belief is yes. This case arose out of John and Roberta Batcher, also known as Roberta Rogers, marriage, they were married in 1972, separated in 2001, filed for separation in 2002. There was state court action in the state of New York where there was a settlement agreement initially in March of 2005, followed by a court hearing in the state of New York in November 2006. That November 2006 court hearing is in the record before the agency in pages 647 to 680, which deals with the testimony at hand, which goes into detail of this waiver. Subsequently, they were divorced in 2010, and a claim for apportionment was filed in the interim in 2008. Mr. Batcher is currently under total disability, individual unemployability. He filed a claim for VA benefits and was granted this in September 2006. In this matter, there was a court hearing in November 2006, in which there was extensive negotiations by the parties, both parties represented by attorneys in family court. In that family court settlement, there was an amount agreed upon of $7,000, which was paid per the court's instructions by the end of November. It was paid at the end of November of 2006, in which Mrs. Batcher, otherwise known as Roberta Rogers, agreed to waive any past or future maintenance payments.
Now, I have a question about the facts here. The record wasn't entirely clear. At the time of the 2006 stipulated agreement, and also maybe at the time of the March 2005 agreement, mm-hmm. was Mr. Batcher had already applied for VA compensation benefits?
He had applied. He actually received a decision in September of 2006, granting a 40% rating at that point. As far as the 2005 agreement, there's a note in there saying a claim going back to March of 2005.
Right.
And there was another note saying one of his other conditions go back to March of 2006. It's a little difficult to tell, given, I think, what went on with the namer, how exactly they went back. But I know that there was a decision issued in September 2006 granting him that. So, and while the record does not have a discussion about VA benefits in the court's in November 2006, which essentially was there were disagreements and issues that arose with the 2005, which they went back and had this hearing, which resulted in agreement from it in November 2006. At that point in November 2006, he was receiving VA benefits. The claim was there, and he was granted. So was it discussed is an issue that could arise. I would take the language at its plain meaning that when they said past and future maintenance, it would include any past, including health insurance, it was included in that, it would be past and future support maintenance, and it is the appellant's position that that resulted in a waiver by Roberta Batcher of her future right to apportionment. And
we're not even sure at this point whether the Suffolk County Court was aware of his imminent entitlement to or his claim for VA disability benefits and or imminent receipt of VA disability benefits.
It is not clear from the record. The only thing that the record does state is there was extensive negotiations as to what occurred in those negotiations. The only thing I can say that there was a September 2006 ratings decision granting him benefits, which I would hope that counsel of both sides had discussed, but it is not in something in the transcript where they had had a discussion about it saying, what about, you know, he's getting VA benefits, how this impacts.
Well, should it make any difference?
I don't think it should, Your Honor, because
he might win the lottery also.
Right, and that is my exact point. When she waives future maintenance, the issue is she accepted payment. Now, it's to her benefit, per se, if there's a divorce case. I mean, similarly in Rose, to have the VA administrator interjecting themselves into these state court matters could result in piecemeal litigation, which is exactly what we want to avoid here. In this situation...
Here's where I'm at on this. I think if the board had determined the decision based on 3.450, the general apportionment, then I think your argument holds. I think you're in a good place. The problem is special apportionment, the 451, really, it just requires a showing of hardship, right? I mean, there's no discharge, you know, the general apportionment says whether a veteran's reasonably discharging the duties. I mean, everything you say might be relevant to that. But she only has to demonstrate hardship, whether she waived rights or all of that is, in a sense, immaterial under 451.
Well, Your Honor, my response to that would be that under Janssen, this court has held that if someone, a recipient can knowingly, freely, and voluntarily waive the right to benefits. And Janssen was a case where they had counsel. This is a matter where Roberta Rogers had counsel. Ms. White was her attorney. She was asked by the court if she knowingly and freely voluntarily entered into this agreement. They went over the effect of it. They said it was future maintenance and past maintenance, and it settled it. And so my argument with that would be that she voluntarily waived her rights pursuant to that November 2006 court hearing and the agreement that came out of that.
What's your position on the VA representing a party here?
Well, my position, Your Honor, is simply put, is similar to Rose, that the VA were to interplead themselves in family court matters. Settlement agreements occur often in family court cases. For them to interplead, I think similar in Rose, would be taking a position that, you know, this is a matter primarily of state law. Family law matters are primarily of those. And Manziel said that, Rose said that too. For them to interplead in these cases could result in piecemeal litigation. The point is, there was a decision in this case, of settlement agreement, from 2006. We're now almost 12 years ago. A divorce that occurred in 2010. And, you know, she waived it. She's got a right to waive her benefits. And it is our belief that, similar in Janssen, she had an attorney. She voluntarily, freely was advised of her rights. She was, as I said, represented by counsel and knowingly waived right to any past or future maintenance. If there was to be a clarification on that, that could have occurred to the state courts. There was no such clarification occurred. This was the agreement was done. They had extensive negotiation. They talked about her health at the time. They talked about her being unemployed, having disabilities. So there was a lot that went into this when the state court decided. And since settlement agreements related in family law cases are a matter of state court law, for the VA to interject themselves into this, I think is beyond what even the court in Rose.
Point taken. I understand what you're saying. But if this is a matter of state court law, then why didn't Mr. Batcher take the board decision and go to the state court and say, hey, look, this was a contract we had, essentially, this agreement, and she has violated it? And question riffing off of that is, do you know, has he done so? Is he pursuing that avenue simultaneous with appealing to this court?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I think that from the record before the agency, I saw that his contention was is that the state court decision was decided, the divorce was granted, there was the separation agreements occurred with the modification in November 2006, and therefore it was decided by then. I also think that allowing Roberta Rogers to have another opportunity for this starts bleeding into the areas of res judicata. She gets another bite of the apple. I think she could the argument can be made that why didn't she go back to state court and say, well, when she had an attorney saying, this only encompasses this. Or instead, it's a broad term. It says future maintenance. And future maintenance means support. And the support would, Mr. Batchelor's argument is it includes the waiver of apportionment.
I mean, you haven't brought any type of a due process challenge against 3.451, right? I mean, under that reg as designed, basically all a person seeking an apportionment has to do is petition VA and then make a showing of hardship. Right?
Yes.
I mean, what happens in a state court or any collateral litigation elsewhere, agreements or anything like that, isn't directly relevant to the question under the reg?
Well, Your Honor, I think the issue that's relevant is that anyone under Janssen can waive the right to a benefit. She has waived this right. She waived it in state court, represented by counsel. And so as a result of this waiver, she shouldn't be entitled to these benefits. I mean, one of the things that when this case initially started with was a reasons and basis argument over the fact that waiver was not discussed by the Board of Veterans' Appeals. But in this argument here, I think that when you have an area that's traditionally the realm of state courts, as the Supreme Court has said over and over again, and you also have, the Howe case came down in the middle of this in 2017 and said that the state courts, while they can't say I'm dividing your veterans' disability, your retirement benefits are waived for veterans' disability compensation, they can take a look at all of the assets, sources of income, I should say, in determining spousal support. Similarly here, the court could take a look at all of the income sources and say, look, we're granting a waiver. I mean, she contracted it away as a result of it. There was no provision that said future maintenance except for this or anything to that matter. It was just future maintenance, and then there was some discussion about retirement and ING fund, but it was not anything beyond that.
Well, that's kind of precisely why I was asking a question about when she became aware, and do you think she was aware at the time of the 2005 and 2006 agreements that he intended to or had already applied for VA benefits? And I know you cannot speak to what she knew or did not know,
yeah, sure.
But I'm just making the point that that was the reason for my question. I mean, you can't waive something that you're not aware of, and so her awareness of that, if you're going to pursue the waiver argument here, is questionable.
The only thing I can say about the being aware of is I do know that there was in existence 2 months prior to this, approximately, the fact he was granted benefits, okay? As far as, Your Honor, if this was discussed, I mean, that's not clear. But she did have an attorney. I would hope that there was a discussion between counsel about sources of income and revenue, but it's not, in all honesty, it's not clear from that.
I just have to note that I don't have the agreement in front of me. I mean, I do have it, but I don't want to go find it right now. But I did notice the imprecision with which they referred to Army benefits. It was not very precise. It was like, does anyone remember how they said it? It was just a very imprecise way of talking about his military benefits.
Yes.
It was almost like haphazard and throwaway, like as though they weren't bothering to nail down what he was actually entitled to. And it was almost funny. I mean, it was just so casual.
Your Honor, to be honest, if there was more verbiage, it would probably be beneficial and may have made this matter a lot easier.
Yeah, but doesn't that really advance your argument? She knew about it. She knew who she was married to. There's reference to military, army benefits. So she knew that the issue was there, and it wasn't separated out in this agreement.
Correct, Your Honor. She knew about
it. So what business does the VA have in being here, I'm asking you, in taking away a benefit intended by Congress for veterans?
I don't think the VA has a business in this, Your Honor, because the situation we have here is one in which We had Rose where there was a contempt order and it dealt with child support. And they said it's not the VA's domain to get involved in all these. Similarly, for the VA to get involved in all these, my fear is that it could create a situation where a veteran goes to court, gets divorced, and maybe even the benefit for the veteran and his or her spouse, where they come to a settlement agreement saying, look, I want to move on with my life. I want X number of dollars. Let's just do a separation agreement. We're done. The court can look at all the assets and sources of income. And then you have an apportionment claim made, and then you have more confusion going on where you have reopening of state court decisions, cases going back and forth, when the simple fact of the matter is, if she has the right to waive her benefits, which she does pursuant to the court's ruling in Janssen, then in this case she has waived her benefit. If there was something more that needed to be said, the plain language says future maintenance. Then that way that was waived.
Don't we have a due process issue here? I mean, the VA is coming in to take away this benefit, which by hundreds of years of jurisprudence properly belongs in a state court. Do you agree?
I agree, Your Honor.
So if she had a problem, go back to state court. Isn't that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what business does the VA have in taking her part in this case?
None, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the one of the things that occurs is that's exactly the argument I'm making with res judicata. It's been decided. If this was something, then there was a period of time from 2006 to 2010 they could have gone back and said, well, someone's in breach. Or they could have had negotiations in 2006 when you're represented by counsel and said it. When you make an agreement and you say future maintenance, similar to the Lauder discussion, she's waiving. If in the future maintenance, if he hit the lotto and hit for, $10 million 2 years later, they've already come to an agreement at that point.
Right, but the remedy to enforce that is in the court of the state of the jurisdiction in which whatever agreement that would be. I mean, it might be res judicata in the state of New York, but this is, the Veterans Administration has a procedure. They've laid out regulations. They've cited their statutory authority for how they apportion money. I mean, it doesn't. I don't see anywhere in the plain language of the reg where it takes into account private agreements between the parties. And that's the difficulty I'm having with your argument. I mean, I understand there's a certain tidy logic factually to it, but where's the authority for us since to reverse the board decision based on the error of their reading of the regs?
The authority, Your Honor, comes from that you're entitled, pursuant to this court's ruling in Janssen, she can waive her rights to any benefits. A veteran, or in this case, that she's entitled to, she can waive her rights.
Certainly. And your client can go to the state of New York and vindicate his rights. But I just don't see, unless, in a sense, I don't see waiver as an affirmative defense, as it were, in this 3.451, right? All I see is a reg that says where a person makes a showing of hardship, then there's a sort of burden shifting, it looks like, to the veteran to then make a showing of hardship. So if I had to read in some type of waiver defense, it would have to be that it would constitute a hardship to the veteran because of some collateral agreement that the veteran's made. That's not quite the argument that you're making.
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is that there is a way. She waived her right to these benefits, simply put. She could have considered it then. She had counsel. She waived it. Janssen says that you can knowingly, voluntarily, and freely waive a right that you have. She knowingly, voluntarily, and freely waived it. She had counsel at the point. Janssen, I don't believe, makes a distinction saying between this type of right, this type of benefit versus that type of benefit. You can waive that right. The court in Janssen said, I believe, and I'm paraphrasing, that, it's presumed, unless specifically said you can't do it, that you can waive rights, okay? She has waived her right to this. And that's why, it's simply put, even though maybe it would have been better if the court had more verbiage, but the thing is at the same point, it has to go for on her side, too, saying that they should have, if they wanted to exclude something, they could have put that in there. When you look at the plain meaning of the language, and it says past maintenance and future maintenance, included the support and would have included the apportionment, a claim for apportionment, excuse me, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't the Howell case direct that you would seek redress in the state court? for a violation of a separation agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Howe would. And the point of going back to Howe, when you're looking at the state court looking at a separation agreement, similarly how Howe talked about it, can look at all sources of income in determining support, the state court agreement here could have looked at all sources of income and determined if she wanted to waive it. I mean, this was not something where the court said, like Howe, there was no indemnification agreement here, like in Howe. This was something where the court could look at all sources. So they looked at all sources and determined she waived her rights. And that's the appellant's position here.
But we have no evidence that the all sources at that time included the fact that he had applied for or was in imminent receipt of VA benefits.
We do know that he did was granted VA benefits per a decision of September 2006, 2 months prior to the November 2006 hearing. The only thing to do is infer from the plain meaning of the language. Did they put that on the record and say this includes that? No, there was not a specific thing where they said that. However, it was valid. Would it be something that the attorney and the family court should have discussed between attorneys? Possibly. Did they discuss it? I don't know. It's possible they did, possibly they didn't. The only thing that that transcript says is talks about extensive negotiations.
Well, why should we look beyond the document?
That's the plain meaning of the language.
Is your argument that there's a negotiation, knowledgeable people, lawyers on both sides? We have a document.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. We have a document. It's plain meaning of the language, future maintenance. Waived. And that waiver results in a waiver of proportional benefits.
And apparently there was consideration for the contract, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
Both got to walk away free from the marriage.
Yes.
What the future brings, it brings.
Correct.
Right?
Correct, Your Honor. I mean,
don't feel the need to keep going.
All right. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, I think, are there any questions?
I'd save time for rebuttal.
I'll reserve the 7 minutes remaining for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Camaradas.
Good afternoon again, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Brian Thompson and Chris Attaway on behalf of the Secretary. The Secretary respectfully submits that a state court is without authority to order VA to grant or deny benefits. VA administers a federal statutory program in which benefits are awarded. VA has been tasked by Congress as the adjudicator. Excuse me. Nowhere in Title 38 did Congress defer to state courts or authorize state courts to adjudicate an issue if it is a family law issue. To the contrary, they explicitly directed that VA may adjudicate apportioning of benefit when
a veteran. What statute is that?
What statute
is that?
38 U.S.C. 5307 is the apportionment statute at issue here. And by doing so, Congress made clear that even though generally the federal government treads lightly when it comes to family law issues and other issues that are traditional state law issues, in this instance, they departed from that general practice. And I think that the reason they departed from that general practice can be found in 38 U.S.C. 5301. Subsection A makes clear that...
Let me interrupt, counsel, really quick, because I noticed when you look at 3.450 and then you look at the statutory authority underneath it, it does cite to 38 U.S.C. 5307, and then when you flip to the next reg, which is the one on which the board actually made the decision, they just generally cite 38 U.S.C. 501A, right? And to me, when you look at the two regs, the big difference is the first one has, one of the elements is where the veteran is not reasonably discharging his or her responsibility for the spouse or children's support. Does that make sense if they would tag that to the authority of the statute that deals with that? Whereas the statutory authority for 3.451 is general. I mean, that's just basically the Secretary's general ability to write regulations. I'm wondering why it isn't something more targeted.
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand your question, you're kind of trying to explore whether or not 38 CFR 3.451 is within the scope of 38 USC 5307.
What statute is it tied to in terms of it doesn't really require anything other than a showing of hardship? It seems
correct.
Totally divorced from considerations of family law.
Well, Your Honor, 5307 itself does authorize VA to promulgate regulations. And yes, in the Federal Register notice, when VA was promulgating 3.451, they referred to our general authority to promulgate regulations. But 5307 itself, in fact, allows VA to apportion up to the entirety of the veteran's benefits in certain situations. And the statutory requirement that is applicable both to 3.450 and 3.451 is that the veteran and the spouse are still married but are living separately. There are several other provisions that address children that are not in play here. But regarding spouses, the marriage must be in existence. It can't be a divorce yet, and the parties have to be living separately. That's a provision that applies to 3.451 and 3.450 equally. So it is VA's position that it is well within our authority to create 3.451 and to create a situation in which VA may look at the hardship. As you pointed out, that's the central inquiry in 3.451. As opposed to 3.450, which, as you also pointed out, is looking more at is the veteran discharging his or her duties to the family? Are they providing for the family? And in 3.451, that's not a requirement, and nor is that a statutory requirement.
Yeah, no, what I mean by that is when you look at 3.450 and that part about the discharge and the duties, it's tied much closer to, if you look at the purposes of the statutes, you know, from which it derives its authority, where 3.451 just seems to suggest that if a family member can demonstrate hardship in some dependency relationship, they can petition. I don't know what, in a sense, how closely tied that is to any of the statutory schemes that we've cited in the cases and so forth.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for not better addressing your question. Again, I would touch on the idea that the grant of authority under 5307 is extremely broad, and there are really no parameters in the statute other than the married but living separately. And certainly there's no aspect of 3.451 that is in conflict with that. In terms of VA's purpose or VA's goal, Rose versus Rose, the Supreme Court had an extensive discussion of that. And the idea that veterans' benefits, and since the founding of the Veterans Administration and its predecessors, has been to provide for the veterans, but also for their families. And recognizing that the families of veterans at times bear a huge cost as well. And obviously the most extreme example is loss of life of a family member, but not just loss of life. And so the idea that VA would look for, would have an interest in and would try to take care of the families of veterans as well as veterans is absolutely in line with VA's purpose, and Rose has an extensive discussion of that. I would also note that 3.451 has a balancing test, and so it is not just that the spouse or the kids show a hardship and then VA deprives the veteran and leaves the veteran in hard circumstances. It is a hardship must be established at the threshold by the family member, but then VA also may consider the hardship and the circumstances, the disability, the entirety of the veteran's circumstance as well.
And did the veteran here submit any evidence on that point?
No, Your Honor, that's the board discussed that the veteran had the opportunity to submit evidence regarding his hardship and whether or not this would create one, and he chose not to.
Well, wait a minute. Who's got the burden of proof here? The VA taking away a benefit from a veteran or the veteran?
Your Honor,
what did the BVA do at the board level or at any level? What did the VA do to advised the veteran that he ought to come forward, demonstrating, according to you, that there was a hardship on him. Let's just stop for a moment.
I apologize.
The benefits were given, were conferred, beginning in 2006. Is that correct?
It wasn't the beginning of 2006. It was a decision was promulgated in September of 2006.
Six.
That was the first time that the veteran received benefits. His application was in March of 2006.
Right.
That was, I believe, about 5 or 6 years after separation, and I believe 4 or 5 years after application for divorce in New York. That was the first time he applied for VA benefits.
And where is the, what was the status of the case when this matter arose?
In the separation in New York was in March of 2005. New York issued an order for support and started the process of splitting up the family benefits in July of 2005. Then and as part of that order, they found that the veteran had not submitted materials that they had asked him for regarding his circumstances and his finances. Less than a year later, in March 2006, the veteran first applied for VA benefits. Approximately 6 months later, in September 2006, VA for the first time granted benefits. There was a hearing that was discussed with opposing counsel in September of 2006.
That was a hearing in New York?
Correct.
In a state court?
Correct.
Out of which arose an agreement, a settlement, is that right?
Also correct.
And at the time he was receiving veterans benefits, at the time of that settlement?
That's correct.
So again, my question is, what obligation does the veteran have to come forward under this statutory or regulatory scheme to maintain benefits already granted by the VA?
Your Honor, a claim for apportionment is a simultaneously contested claim. That's a statutory and regulatory vehicle within VA. So both the veteran and his or her former spouse or children are considered claimants. In this particular case, VA repeatedly provided notice to both the veteran and to the spouse, his former spouse, regarding the ongoing claim. The claim for apportionment was submitted to VA in April of 2008, so several years later. It appears that the spouse was not made aware of the application for veterans benefits until the monies that she was receiving from the Department of the DFAS, the Army's retirement program, which the state court addressed, those were essentially eliminated. I think it went from approximately $800 a month to approximately $60 a month. That, in some of the statements from the former spouse, appears to be the first time she was aware her husband had ever, her current husband, they didn't get divorced until 2010, that he had applied for veterans benefits. The first month that the spouse received a reduced payment from the Army, she applied for apportionment to veterans, to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and said he's transferred his money from military retirement pay to veterans disability pay, and the Army is no longer paying me these monies, this approximately $800 a month that I was receiving before. I believe the former spouse went on to establish that she was herself disabled, that she was homeless for a period of the time for which she's asking for benefits. And there's a discussion of this in the board's decision about how she demonstrated her hardship, and I don't think there's a dispute by opposing counsel regarding the evidence used to establish her hardship. I don't need to belabor that point. But again, it's VA's position that VA disability benefits are a federal benefit and that Congress, specifically via 38 U.S.C. 5307, put it in VA's hands to determine how those benefits are distributed between a veteran, and a former spouse when the criteria of 5307 are met, which is a subset. It can't apply after divorce. Congress has spoken to benefits, federal benefits, in other contexts regarding retirement benefits, which I was mentioning earlier, and Judge Bartley, which you talked about previously, that the state court had divvied those up, that it had issued an order about what portion of the veterans' Army retirement fund would be paid to his spouse, then current spouse. Congress addressed Army retirement benefits in response to McCarty versus McCarty, a Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court said these benefits can't be distributed. They're not marital property. Congress changed that, and this is a 10 U.S.C. 1408. It's in our supplemental response. And Congress made very clear both that Army or military retirement benefits were now a divisible marital asset, meaning that state courts could address them, could split them up, and they also made equally clear that VA benefits, disability benefits, were not. And so a state court is without authority to distribute VA disability benefits as part of a divorce decree. This is something that the Supreme Court said in Mansell, and again more recently in Howell. In Howell, they decided that it doesn't matter when the election is made, sort of before or after. There is an alternative sort of process by which a former spouse or current spouse may be able to get support from his or her husband, his or her former spouse. And that would be alimony, spousal support, child support. I don't have an extensive family law background, and so I've kind of thought of the divisible marital asset as being akin to a house, and support as being alimony, child support, those kind of things. Those were something that I was somewhat familiar with. The Supreme Court also addressed the spousal support, the alimony, the child support in Rose versus Rose, and they held that a state court does have a limited ability to interact with VA disability benefits in that context. And in that context, when they're assigning, when a state court, a family court, is assigning spousal support, alimony, child support, they can consider that the money that a veteran is receiving as disability benefits. And this is something that they can put into their math. But that court was also quite clear, in my reading, that a state court has no authority to order VA to pay disability benefits to a spouse, to a former spouse. So Rose does not stand for the proposition that a state court can order VA to distribute benefits in any particular way. In fact, none of the cases, including Mansell, going back to McCarty versus McCarty, prior to that, Ridgway, none of these cases involve VA taking action.
Yeah, no, I don't think, nobody questions that states have no authority to kind of enter into a federal regulatory scheme. But my question is more, if you look at 3451, I mean, the way that it's drafted, it's very much sort of an equity provision where it just says, hey, if somebody makes a showing of hardship, and then I guess the veteran can rebut that with a showing of hardship. But why should, I mean, just a practical matter, I mean, and I know from my experience with anything with the military, that divorce agreements like this are not uncommon, even though this is something we don't litigate very often or don't see that often. I can see this type of scenario is not being all that unique. Should the reg not sort of take into account for the existence of state court agreements? For, you know, presumably if a person's not living with a spouse, it's very likely that they have some type of property agreement or family law agreement with, you know, amongst themselves as to how to divide it up. Shouldn't that be a factor that would be relevant under 3.451 as to whether there's a showing of hardship?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I apologize. I would say that there's nothing in 3.451 that prevents the board from considering exactly those issues. And in fact, in this board decision, the board went through the record. They looked at what had happened in state court, and they considered explicitly that in deciding whether or not a hardship was established. There's no dispute, and certainly I apologize if I've been unclear, there's no argument from VA's side that what happens in the family court is not relevant to 3.450 and 3.451. It absolutely is. Our argument is that what goes on in a family court, in a state family court, is not dispositive regarding what actions VA can or cannot take under statute. And to hold otherwise would be, in our view, a violation of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. We're operating pursuant to federal statutory system. A state court ordering us to pay benefits violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Equally, a state court ordering us to not pay benefits is the same thing. VA is the adjudicator of federal benefits. And to return to a point, have I answered your question? I don't mean to move off of it. Okay. To return to a point I was trying to make earlier, 38 U.S.C. 5301 puts veterans' benefits in disability benefits in a uniquely protected category. They are not subject to attachment in state courts before or after receipt, with very few exceptions. There must be a statutory exception. This is the language of 5301. And that was really what the Supreme Court was wrestling with, was does 5301 prevent a state court from doing anything, even considering the fact that a veteran is receiving, you know, potentially thousands of dollars a month in disability benefits. And what, in my reading, Roe's court came up with is they can consider it, but they cannot order VA to pay. And so they can say, well, veteran, your total income is X, and, you know, part of that X is made up by VA disability benefits. You should pay alimony of Y to your former spouse. And that was the Roe's balance. But 5301 is a provision that I think is denotes how much deference and how much consideration for veterans Congress has. They want to protect the money that Congress, that the federal taxpayer,
well, that's
is
what
giving.
That's what we're here about. Forget all the state court activity or inactivity. We're here to decide whether the VA acted properly here in taking the money from the veteran under these circumstances. So what's your argument? Simply put.
5307 allows, arguably requires VA to apportion benefits in certain circumstances. VA's promulgated correctly promulgated a regulation implementing that statutory authority.
But
and
to,
correctly, under
to
the
go
facts
back,
of this case.
To go back to Judge Toth's line of questioning earlier, that the authority for 3.451 is not 5307, correct? The authority is 501A?
Your Honor, I think the authority is both. The authority that was published in the Federal Register, I believe, specifically refers to 501.
To 501, right.
But I think that the entirety of that subsection of regulations is based on 38 U.S.C. 5307.
Well, do you need 5307? You seem anxious to go back and use that as a support, but the fact is the agency never cited to it, even though it's the regulation right after the regulation that is authorized by 5307. But nevertheless, the specific regulation, 3.451, doesn't mention it. Do you need anything more than 501A to support
Your Honor,
this?
I apologize.
Do you need anything other than 501A to support the regulation?
I think 501A is sufficient to support the regulation. However, VA has also, and I believe that there's case law addressing this as well, there is a requirement from 5307, the married but living separately requirement, and that has been imported into 38 CFR 3.451. And I also think it's important to note that there's nothing in 3.451 that is inconsistent with 5307. So while VA does have sort of general authority to promulgate regulations, it's our position that it is consistent with and supported by 5307 to promulgate a 3.451, although our specific authority was the general authority to promulgate regulations.
Okay. I have one other question. This had just occurred to me, actually, and I have not looked at the rating charts that say how much money you're going to get for a particular, you know, percentage of disability. But those charts do allow a veteran to get more if they have a spouse and or children, right? Let's say this veteran initially, under my reading, this veteran, Mr. Batcher, received a 20% effective March of 2005, let's say. And so do you know if at that time he was being paid as a married veteran? Like, was he receiving the extra amount for a spouse that people who are married usually receive when they get a 20% evaluation?
I understand your question, Your Honor, and I went back and I looked at those payments, but I was primarily looking to establish the timeline of his claim. I believe off the top of my head that he was getting the marital bump, but I honestly was not looking at that issue, and I couldn't swear to that. That's something that I can certainly investigate in the record, and I could provide a supplement. I don't want to overstate my certainty. So I believe so, but I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, I would appreciate knowing whether he was paid as a married spouse and so received what you're calling the bump up for compensation during these years that we're talking about.
Yes,
that,
Your Honor.
That would be helpful.
That's absolutely in the record for the agency, and I can provide a supplement.
Within 7 days of?
Certainly.
Of the argument?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
What about the waiver argument? What's the government's position on that?
There are a couple aspects or points that I would like to make regarding the waiver argument. First, there was no waiver that was made to VA, and consistent with Janssen and other case law from this court, a waiver made to VA is a thing that can exist. Parties can waive benefits before the government, but talking about something before a state court that has no jurisdiction over VA to grant or deny benefits, we respectfully submit that is not a waiver before VA. And so whatever was discussed when the hearing record was off, and there's nothing in the record that indicates VA benefits were discussed, but even if they were, that is not a waiver before VA. So the spouse in this case never submitted a waiver to VA. And again, it's our position that VA is not bound by state court orders regardless. I would also submit that it is, I looked at this question a fair amount going through the record, and I was unable to find anything that indicated that VA benefits at all were discussed or apportionment of VA benefits. Again, benefits were granted for the first time a mere 2 months before the November hearing.
But they were
relying on.
Why do you say a mere 2 months? They were. They were known to both parties at the time this state court agreement was entered into.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
I mean, does this
that.
Mean that every time a veteran thinks he's over and done with a contractual situation, that he's got to worry about the VA coming in 8 years later and taking away a certain portion of that benefit because the VA has made an independent judgment? You think you're allowed to do that under this statutory scheme?
Respectfully, Your Honor, yes. And I would also say,
you think
again,
that's what Congress had in mind by this statutory scheme?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's
right, as long as I understand.
I think that's the only possible reading of 30 U.S.C. 5307. And the Supreme Court addressed sort of the kind of problem set that you're talking. It's a companion problem set. It's the problem that the spouse of the veteran faces when a veteran...
Former spouse.
No.
I know we're talking only about the period of time they were married. That's the claim here, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And now former spouse. But how was it dealing with apportionment, just so I'm clear? How was dealing with military retired pay, which a state court had validly divvied up between the parties, and years later, after that agreement had been made, the veteran transferred, he rescinded his military retirement pay, and accepted VA's disability benefits and their tax benefits for that. It's an intuitive proposition. But by doing so, because of 10 U.S.C. 1408, 42 U.S.C. 659, all of which is in our supplemental brief, he also removed that money from the state court's jurisdiction. And the Howell court said, this can create a hardship on the former spouse of the veteran. But the fact that a hardship is created doesn't change preemption. It doesn't change the statutory regime. It doesn't eliminate the supremacy clause of the Constitution. Congress is free to amend the statutory system and to distribute monies differently. And in fact, in this very body of cases, that's exactly what happened after McCarty versus McCarty. 10 U.S.C. 1408 was amended. But as the statutes are currently written, that consequence is a natural outcome.
That's well taken, but Judge Weaver mentioned due process. Certainly, I mean, I know this is not part of the case, and this would be a higher level analysis, but the Congress had written a statute and said, we'll give you benefits until we decide not to. We'll just sort of, for no reason, take them away and give them to somebody else. I mean, there has to be a meaningful standard for what constitutes hardship.
Your Honor, I would say that there are no due process concerns in this case or regarding apportionment generally. The notice provisions regarding simultaneously contested claims are significant.
But there has to be a meaningful standard for what constitutes hardship. It can't be arbitrary. It can't be, okay, we like you, we don't like you. I mean, there has to be some standard by which the board consistently adjudicates what constitutes hardship.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that, just to be clear, as a matter of statutory authority, Congress can create a level of discretion that goes to what you're talking about. And I don't think that they necessarily did here. And as this court found in Costa...
Well, I mean, constitutionally, Congress can certainly set up a statutory scheme by which they say, this qualifies for benefits and this. And they can certainly set the terms by which people get benefits. But once they sort of lock a set of vested benefits in, then there are due process constitutional concerns that attach that even Congress couldn't change. For instance, I mean, once somebody is getting a check month after month after month after month, and they, in a sense, their benefits are vested, to take that away, at least constitutionally, would require certain due process considerations, right? I mean, opportunity to hearing something.
I apologize, Your Honor, my time's up. I'm happy to respond to your question.
Let's add 5 minutes, please.
If I may, I don't think that VA's position is any different than yours. I think that there's both the apportionment process, and there are also statutory and regulatory provisions talking about reducing a benefit. And to the best of my knowledge, all of those were followed here. In fact, I believe at one point the board remanded to ensure that the veteran had proper notice of one aspect of the case.
Yeah, no, and that's not an issue. I mean, I was just sort of thinking out loud and wanted to get your take on this, but I do have a specific question. I mean, what is the standard for hardship? Is it just a totality of circumstances? We look at the facts, or is there a sort of set standard that the board would follow?
Well, 3.451 has a number of variables, things that it points to look at. I don't believe that list is intended to be exclusive, but the items identified therein are the quantity of the disability payment. And I think that mitigates to the hardship of the veteran potentially might face by losing the potentially small amount of money that he or she may have, or if a veteran is receiving more money, then that weighs the other way. Additionally, the resources of both parties, and there's I think a special attention paid to kids. The alternative resources outside of VA benefits that people are brought in. And then lastly, the special circumstances, the disabilities, the hardship. I don't mean the return to hardships. That's not actually that's my mistake. The regulation doesn't define hardship by referring to hardship. But the physical or other challenges that that both the veteran and his or her family member's face is another factor. So I think there are enumerated factors in 3.451 itself. It's not just the word hardship. And I think the board decision also addressed why it found that this now former spouse faced hardship and provided adequate reasons or basis in doing so.
Now, I have a few practical questions. So this decision came out in, what was the month, this decision? What month and year, the board decision?
Your Honor, let me look. December 17th of 2015.
Okay,
sorry.
Okay. And so was apportionment then kind of immediately being taken out of his current, I know he gets TDI, he gets total disability based on individual unemployability benefits now, which is, I think, over $3,000 a month. It was the 20%, no, we're talking about the 20%, but so there was a total, I don't know what to call it here because I'm not used to dealing in apportionment terms, but 20% of the amounts that he was getting from 2008 to 2010, he now owes her, and that is a total of how much money, roughly? Just an estimate.
Your Honor,
if they were to implement
this, I've never
done
the math.
I thought it was around $15,000.
Okay, I mean, that sounds right? Intuitive, but I didn't do the math.
So well, my question is, how are they, is there a mechanism by which they are giving that to her now, or hasn't this even been implemented yet, or don't you know?
In my looking at the record, I don't believe it has been implemented because this case is ongoing. So I don't believe that his benefits have been reduced, although, again, that's an issue that I can confirm. Generally, when a debt is
but owed... That was my question. Would this be paid via a debt or an overpayment or whatever? Would that be the mechanism for an apportionment, a retroactive apportionment decision? Do you know? The mechanism for the former spouse to recoup, would that be a debt?
I believe that...
Or overpayment kind of situation?
Yes, Sean, I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt. I believe that on remand, the regional office would issue a decision that would, if affirmed by this court, that would grant the money and do the math and give that to the now former spouse. Then the issue debt would be created for the veteran, and there are statutes and regulations that apply to VA collecting debts based on a participation in a benefit program, and there are equitable considerations in terms of whether or not VA will waive the debt, and it would be treated as any other debt case.
Okay. I wasn't sure that debt would be the mechanism when what we're talking about is a retroactive special apportionment.
Well, I believe that the debt provisions, because they are so favorable to veterans and require VA to consider the equity and whether or not it can, in good conscience, collect the debt, are quite veteran friendly. And so that is my understanding of what would happen next. I apologize. My time's up again.
Yes. Any more questions?
Yeah. What role?
If you could add 3 minutes, please.
What role, if any, did the fact that this is a combat-wounded veteran play in the determination by the board in making its balancing test on hardship?
Your Honor, I don't believe, off the top of my head, that the board specifically referred to the fact that he was in combat. I believe that it did consider...
A wounded combat veteran.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it considered his disability. To the best of my knowledge, the board didn't go beyond that.
What's bothering me here is if you're saying that the VA gets to go in any time it gets an application from a former spouse saying the former spouse is suffering a hardship currently but wants to be paid on the basis of having lived together as husband and wife, but perhaps separate, 8-9 years earlier, how does that square with due process notions when it comes to Congress clearly intending to favor a veteran over all other classes, except in certain circumstances, which you're arguing apply here.
Yes, Your Honor, and just to be clear about the facts of this case, the now former spouse was still married to the veteran for an additional 2 years after she applied for apportionment. This is not someone who's coming back, 8 years later after the marriage has ended. This marriage did not end until 2010, and her application was in 2008.
Well, that's 2 years after this agreement and the divorce, right?
I believe that the earliest agreement was in 2005, so it was 3 years.
2-3 years. What difference does it make?
Well,
it's after the divorce.
No, I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think I'm making this very clear. Her divorce was in 2010. Their separation started in 2005. So there was a five-year window after separation, legal separation, in which the New York court distributed assets before a Pennsylvania court actually issued the divorce decree.
Pennsylvania or New York?
It was Pennsylvania. During that five-year pendency, a New York court distributed the assets of the marriage, assigned support. The then-current spouse went back four additional times to the New York court because the appellant refused to comply with the New York court's orders. During that process, the appellant also began receiving VA benefits, and the spouse, then-current spouse, applied for apportionment of those benefits. So that entire five-year period, these issues were not resolved. And I'm running out of time again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah.
No. Okay.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Camarotas, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First off, as far as the waiver with the VA, as stated in their argument that they weren't a party to it, there was not a form submitted with the VA. This is an agreement in state court. It's an agreement that occurred in state court and from a state judge that should have validity. The cases I've cited previously, Rose, Manziel, Howe, all talk about family law being the domain of the state courts. Rose even talking about absent some major damage to a family. Absent there being some major damage to federal law.
Argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honors. Basically, as long as the state family doesn't do major damage to a clear and substantial federal interest here, you know, looking at 1408, looking at 5307, 5301, looking at those, these don't discuss, as far as clear and substantial federal interest, they don't talk about the issue of waiver occurring. Now, waiver has been stated in the court in Janssen that they can waive benefits. There's 5305, 5306 that talk about them being people being able to waive benefits. So she, the appellant's former spouse waived her benefits when she did this in state court. That is the appellant's contention. As far as the VA being a party to that, this again, my concern is the slippery slope that if you say that the state court family settlement agreement that or settlement agreement that occurred of having piecemeal litigation, exactly what Rose said 30 years ago almost, that would occur. We have the VA administrator stepping in. In that case, they talk about the VA administrator stepping in on child support decisions. And so is this what Congress intended? Now, the court there said Congress didn't intend for the VA administrator to step in on child support decisions. Here, this is not a situation where the court has said, I've divided as marital property your VA benefits, contrary to Howell and Manziel and Rose. This is a situation where they have once spouse, by the clear meaning of the language, has agreed and waived her right to these benefits, and as such, should be giving its full force and effect. This was a contentious divorce. As far as the problems went on beforehand, there was issues where allegations were made, and he had issues of being unemployed that were brought up. But the point is, that's why they eventually had this November 2006 conference where it's on the record, and she's represented by counsel, and to work all this out. And that was 2 months after him being awarded VA benefits per the rating decision in September of 06.
We understand.
Yes. Any questions? Any other further questions, Your Honors?
No.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Okay, thank you both very much. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.